time is over, because ultimately when the West withdraws, Afghanistan will still become the object of attention by neighboring states, and Pakistan will not be able to let go. And that's why they joke with each other that next time the Americans will be pleased if we go in with shaven beards. That's all. It's not a big deal. Yeah.
Will Iraq become another Vietnam? And what will the effects be of withdrawing American troops?
Will it become another Vietnam? Well, I don't think any two struggles are ever the same. But certainly there are analogies. What is happening in Iraq is a classic first stage resistance in a guerrilla war. It's classic. Whether it goes beyond that remains to be seen. The big difference with Vietnam is that the Vietnamese leadership was pretty united and had a social vision, which you may or may not agree with, but they certainly had it. And in Iraq, the struggle is very decentralized at this precise point in time. The second part of your question, if the United States were to leave, would the corporations withdraw? Well, I think one of the deals they would try and do is that the corporations stayed. Whether they'll be successful in this is an open question, because the one thing which any Iraqi except Ahmad Chalabi will tell you is that we don't want to get rid of Iraq, we don't want to privatize Iraqi oil. This is the wealth of the country and the people, and it has to be used for them, and the best guardian of that is the Iraqi state. So if they make the mistake of going for the oil and getting the corporations, say Halliburton, to buy large chunks of it, then that might benefit Cheney, but it certainly won't benefit the people of Iraq. And I think they will try and avoid doing that, because all eyes are focused on that. But the rest of the privatizations are already taking place. Yeah.
A question about the role of the UN in resolving the situation in Iraq.
Well, many people see the UN as the US in another guise. Basically, the UN now can't act as independently. It can only do what the United States wants it to do. That's just a fact of life. And most parts of the world have understood that. And so if the UN is used, it'll be as an umbrella to do the US's bidding and to act maybe as a bridge for the US to withdraw. We don't know that as yet, but certainly that would be its only use, so that troops can be kept there under a UN banner rather than the Stars and Stripes. So it won't make any difference to what's going on in Iraq.
A member of the audience asked Ali to clarify his statement regarding opposition to U.S. imperialism prevailing over dissatisfaction with the Saddam Hussein government.
The thing is this, that I didn't say, you misunderstood me. I didn't say that people preferred Saddam Hussein. I said what they prefer to do is to be responsible for getting rid of their own dictators. And I know this from experience in other parts of the world where you've had dictatorships, where if there'd been outside intervention, many people wouldn't have rallied for the dictators, but would have rallied against the outside intervention. And this, the United States only does it where it serves its own interest. After all, one of the worst dictators in the world, the Indonesian dictator Suharto, was left alone for 30 years. This is a guy who'd presided over the massacre of 1.5 million people, with Islamist vigilantes going and carrying out the killings on the island of Bali, supported by the United States, who said it was the best thing that had happened in Asia for decades. And that dictator was left alone. So that's why imperialism is never taken seriously, because people know instinctively, especially people who've been colonized, that imperial interventions are always carried out in the interests of an imperial power. And if you look at the record of the British Empire in India, they left it with 90% of the population illiterate and 85% of the population in the countryside, and only a tiny elite that had been educated, because that was what was in their own interest. If they'd educated the whole population, the British Empire would have come to an end in the early years of the 20th century rather than in the middle of it. That's the point which is being made. It's not the case It's not the case that people in the Arab world or the Islamic world don't understand democratic norms. They do understand them. But the problem is that they sometimes elect governments which the West doesn't like. So democracy can't be democracy if it only elects governments that you like. That's not the purpose of democracy. I mean, if you look at democracy in the United States today, it doesn't matter which party you elect, nothing changes in the system. That's democracy too. And everyone in the world knows that. Now, of course, you could have the election of a government in Iraq, which I wouldn't support, some of the measures they carry out, but that's something you have to live with. Provided the people are given an opportunity to change that government again, they will change it when they're offered that opportunity. And a very good example is what's going on in Iran at the moment, where you have a mass opposition to the rule of the clerics, real big opposition, that, you know, 65% of Iranians are under 25 years of age and 75% are under 35 years of age. And these are people who have just lived under the clerics. And they will get rid of them in their own way and in their own time. But if the United States were to intervene in Iran, it would be a disaster, because it would strengthen the most retrogressive elements in the country, who would then grab the flag and rally everyone around it to resist this invasion. That's the point I was making.
Why is it that in spite of the global protests, no country has opposed the war?
Well, because the United States is a very dominant country and no one wants to antagonize it. They're frightened. They don't want to be left out of a share of the loot. You've seen what's happened in Iraq, that initially the Germans and the French were told they wouldn't get any share of the loot at all, on the old maxim of to the victor the spoils. So that it's as straightforward as that, you know. So they line up to give tribute. There are four questions. I can't... Sorry? That's what I said. Yeah. What about who? Yeah, but the Syrians finally voted in the United Nations to sanctify the war, which they didn't believe in.
Someone asked, did the peace movement miss an opportunity to unify behind the candidacies of Kucinich or Dean? What's his view on electoral strategies for the American peace movement?
Well, the thing is that in the absence of parties which reflect the will of movements, this is always a problem. You know, and it's always a problem in the United States, especially. In Europe, you have parties which reflect the movements, whether they are mainstream or slightly to the left of the mainstream. But here you've always had this, for the last 50 to 60 years, it's been a constant problem, that it's either one or the other. And then it becomes very important what the party you support is actually defending. That's why I said in my speech, it's a real tragedy that the principal candidates on both parties will be people, one who took the country to war and the other who backed it. And I think basically what happened is that Dean didn't prove to be too effective a leader of his own troops and couldn't deliver. And there was no other Democrat who spoke up. And Kerry won by default. But, you know, in an ideal world, and I think sooner or later, the United States will need a third party of some sort. So that people have an alternative to vote for. The problem is that the electoral system functions in such a peculiar way in this country that votes aren't proportional and people aren't elected on a proportional basis, which poses a real problem. It's also a problem in Britain, by the way. But there we have more leeway now. But here that's a massive problem. So, I mean, ideally, from my point of view, it would have been good if there'd been a strong anti-war Democrat who'd got the thing and could have been backed and, mobilized. I think Bush could still be defeated, even with Kerry as the president, and whatever we may think, globally, a defeat for this administration would be seen as a victory. There's no doubt in my mind, because I travel all over the world.
What are the alternatives to the mainstream press, which only presents the pro-war perspective?
Well, there's no easy answer to that, you know. If I had the answer, we'd have done it a long time ago. But all you do is carry on doing what people are doing. I mean, there are more alternatives now than there were in the 60s and 70s, you know, with the internet, with the radio shows, with, you know, the indie media. It's much, much more effective now than it was 30 years ago. I mean, Amy Goodman's show Democracy Now!, it isn't mainstream, but it is listened to by a lot of people, including some people in the mainstream. So that's what one has got to do, is to improve our side of the show, which isn't easy, given that we're always constantly short of money. But I know that there are two key big groups now looking to create a world global alternative to CNN in Canada and the United States. I mean, the Arabs did it with Al Jazeera, which is why it was bombed so often. So that's what you do when you have an alternative media which provides an alternative news and alternative images at the middle of a war, then you send your planes to go and bomb it. I don't think they're going to do that to Amy just yet. But we do need an equivalent of Al Jazeera or something like that in this country.
A questioner who said he was an Iraqi Kurd who'd left the country 18 years ago said he believes that the Iraqi resistance consists of many people who benefited financially from working for the Saddam Hussein regime. At least now, the man commented, the profits from Iraqi oil won't be used to buy weapons to attack the Kurds.
I get your message, my friend. You're a strong defender of the occupation. Well, you should be there now. No, I mean, you know, this is the thing that you... No, don't get... I'm going to answer you, okay? I'm going to answer you because there are people like you in the Kurdish areas, and I defended the Kurds against Saddam Hussein when no one in the West was talking out. We were picketing the Iraqi embassy in London after Halabja when all your so-called liberators were actually arming and defending him. And the record of the Kurds themselves hasn't been exactly exemplary. Anyone who pays money is fine. Whether it's the Shah of Iran, you go with him. When it's the Israelis, you go with him. When it's Saddam Hussein, you go with him. When it's the Americans, you go with him. Is this defending the interests of the Kurdish people? Do you see? But the Kurdish tribal leaders have done that. And I'm not in favor of Kurdish party offices being blown up. I don't know who did it. Most of the resistance groups denied doing it to the Shias. The Shias themselves blamed other people. But if you totally reduce the opposition in Iraq today to Saddam Hussein, you give him too much credit. This guy was even hated within his own party. He killed lots of Baathists, not just Kurds. Lots of some of the best people in the Ba'ath Party were wiped out by him. That's not the problem. The question now is the country is occupied by a foreign power. And many Iraqis, maybe not the Kurds, see that as a problem. And the Kurds too, one day, I think not too long, many of them will begin to see it as a problem as the situation deteriorates. That's my feeling, and we will see. You know, I mean, what happens to Iraq over the next 5 years. But those who thought that this was going to be the solution, I think will prove wrong. I'm getting tired, guys, so can we have them quickly now?
Next, a question about the payment of reparations to Iraq by America and Britain.
Well, if there's an elected government in Iraq, then they should be paid to them. You don't need Western troops on the ground to determine anything. You know, that won't be acceptable. And whether they'll pay reparations is an open question. They were going to fund this whole war through the sale of Iraqi oil. Because when they were asked, how are you going to fund the war, the neocons said, we'll sell the oil. You know, kick his ass, get the gas. That was a Republican Party sticker.
A man asked about 9/11. How likely is it that the U.S. government had prior knowledge of the attack?
Look, this is a big, big debate which goes on inside your country. And it's precisely because the media is so top-heavy and so dominant and so propagandistic that it gives rise to lots of conspiracy theories and theorists, which I can understand. But whether they from the available information, it appears they knew something was about to happen but didn't know what. And I mean, I've been asked in different parts of the United States, do you think we carried out the hits ourselves? And my answer is no. You know, I don't think they knew that this was the exact shape and form of the hits that were going to take place. Who could have known? I mean, it was, you know, just on the level of imagination, very imaginative, horrible though it was. But it's never been done before. It was unpredictable. And I don't think they had information that planes were going to be crashed into Twin Towers and Pentagon. They knew that there was something happening and they couldn't work out what it was. I think that's the most likely explanation. Pearl Harbor, we'll talk next time I come here.
What's the likelihood of the United States attacking Iran and Syria?
I don't think they're going to attack Iran. Because they'll be stopped by their own generals, because they'll be totally overstretched if they do that. As it is, the reserves are drying up in the United States, as people now realize what it means to join the army. It isn't just a wage, and it isn't just a wage, and it isn't just that your schooling might be paid for. It means you might actually be killed. And so the layers from which they're drawing kids to join the army are drying up. So if they decide to occupy Iran, they will need to reintroduce the draft. And for any US president to reintroduce the draft brings back very bitter memories of the Vietnam era and what happened. And you will have a massive increase in the anti-war movement if everyone is obliged to go and fight in imperial wars. And they're aware of that. So if Iraq had gone smoothly and if they'd been welcomed with sweets and flowers and it had all, you know, honey had flowed and there were no problems, no resistance, then people would even have forgotten about the weapons of mass destruction. We wouldn't be having this debate here because lots of people would have said, well, the Iraqis have welcomed them, so what if there weren't any? And they could then have gone and done a few other things, but they can't do that now. The Iraqi resistance from that point of view is very crucial because it has opened up politics to a certain extent in the United States and prevented them from trying to take either Syria or Iran. And if they thought that by capturing Iraq alone would be sufficient to get their way in Syria and Iran, that too is not going to prove likely on deeper and more fundamental questions. So I think they miscalculated. They went into this country and it's backfired very badly. Okay, thank you.
And that was Tariq Ali, author of Bush in Babylon and the Clash of Fundamentalisms, speaking last month in Binghamton, New York. For more information on the March 20th Worldwide Day of Protest against the occupation of Iraq, visit www.unitedforpeace.org. This is Unwelcome Guests.
The invasion of Iraq had a different name originally for a few hours before they realized their acronymic mistake and changed it. We've got a situation and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're gonna make our case and we're gonna make it well. And if you don't like our logic, you can can it. We'll use impeccable intelligence from any country in the world as long as we all see eye to eye. And if we don't find quite what we need, we know what to do. Just look into the camera and lie. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. That's the chorus. Sing with me. We'll lie about the missiles and the nuclear research. We'll lie about uranium. We'll build military bases and smile for reporters as we give away bubble gum. We'll lie about Bin Laden, his connections with the Saudis. We'll lie about 9-1-1. We'll lie about the Baathists, their connections to Al-Qaeda, because we know there's none. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. Oh, that's lovely. You can tell we got the chorus in here as all the ringers. We got 30 ringers. We'll lie about the North Koreans, and we'll lie about Iran, and don't mention Israel. Keep those nuclear weapons out of this song, and we'll all get together swell. And we'll liberate these people, we'll liberate their money, we'll liberate their soil. We'll liberate their harbors, we'll liberate their airports, and we'll liberate their oil. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. One more time. Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L.
David Rovics, Operation Iraqi Liberation. Since last October, I've been reading weekly installments from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Schmidt was trained as a physicist and received his PhD from the University of California. He worked as a writer and editor for Physics Today for 19 years, until he published this book and was fired from his job. I think Disciplined Minds is an important book because, although its title describes a special focus on the social role of professional work and professional training, it really peels back the cover on something much larger: how and why this society fails to live up to what it claims to be about. The contradictions and hypocrisy between the myth and the reality can be found in almost every sphere of activity. Yet it often appears, at least from the behavior of the body politic, that this is not obvious to all, or at least people seem to act as if they didn't notice, or, if they do notice, that they are, for some reason, not outraged by what they see. For those who do feel this outrage deeply, the impression of being surrounded by people who don't care or who seem to approve of a social system that is both brutal and sterile is devastating. The irony of this debilitating alienation is that those who've seen the glitches in the matrix may be more numerous than each lonely dissenter realizes, because we're kept separate by a system that is structured to divide and thus control. This week we begin the final section of the book, the end toward which the book has been building: methods of resistance against the systems designed to produce people who are comfortable with, or at least willing to accept, a place in a social hierarchy of superiors and subordinates. What the next section of the book shows is that what we think, know, and believe are probably the most serious obstacles to creating a society that does not auction off chunks of freedom and dignity to the highest bidder, but makes these principles universal. Now, Chapter 14 of Disciplined Minds, titled Resisting Indoctrination. Schmidt begins with two quotes, one from a former graduate student and one from a former cult indoctrinator. The graduate student said, "The professors were egotistical bastards who tried to impose their perspectives on others. In class, most of them didn't even pretend to want the student to have input. It was like, boom, boom, boom. These are the points. Class is done after I'm done talking." And from the former cult indoctrinator, "I, as the instructor, would say, save your questions until the end of the last session of the course, because if you have a question now, It will probably be answered in some later session. That's the first thing the group controlled, that you're not allowed to ask questions. And recruits would go, well, yeah, it's probably going to be answered better in the class. And that was a quote from a former cult indoctrinator. And Schmidt writes, the strange idea that cult indoctrination might shed light on professional training emerged from my interviews with students. Many of their experiences in graduate and professional school sounded like what goes on in organizations that are accused of brainwashing their members into unthinking clones. Here I am referring to groups that demand total and therefore unquestioning commitment, which of course amounts to complete subordination. Such totalist organizations include military boot camp, gangs, some prison programs, and cults of all types, religious, New Age, human potential, self-help, self-awareness, psychology, therapy, health nutrition, personality, political, commercial sales, and so on. Most organizations in today's society, of course, are not totalist. Organizations ranging from corporations to mainstream unions are hierarchical and undemocratic, but they don't expect to control the totality of their employees' or members' lives. In other words, they are authoritarian, not totalitarian. But it is the totalitarian organizations that give insight into professional training, and so they are the focus of this chapter. One might not expect organizations as different as the Unification Church and the U.S. Marine Corps to have much in common. But rank-and-file Moonies and Marines are the same in one important way. They are not distracted by ideas of their own. In fact, all groups of the type listed above seek to produce such ideologically subordinate beings, who of course make obedient followers. When groups have ends that are the same in such an important way, we shouldn't be surprised to find that their means are the same in important ways, too. Indeed, according to the psychology and anti-cult literature, the same psychological themes dominate life in all groups that, quote, brainwash their members. Professional training programs feature these same themes of obedience and subordination. In this chapter, I describe the themes, which can be boiled down to a list of 8. Like a cult or other totalist organization, a given professional training program will feature most of these themes, but rarely all 8 of them. The particular subset varies from one totalist organization to another, and from one professional training program to another. Each theme can manifest itself in a variety of ways, and I quote former students to illustrate at least one manifestation of each in professional training. Readers will surely be able to fill in other examples. For example, in a totalist organization, we see Note 3, which describes U.S. Marine Corps Basic Training Camp, a single organization that features all 8 themes. The themes operate simultaneously and complement one another. They constitute a system, and so readers will find evidence of more than one theme in each of the quotes below. But am I claiming too much? Is the typical university program really as repressive and subordinating as a cult? My answer is yes, it is, but not so for all students. Students in the same program experience different degrees of subordination. Some students live in fear and work like slaves, while others enjoy a taste of autonomy and set their own pace. Each student negotiates his or her own deal. The same negotiation goes on in cults. But students are in a stronger position than cult members to resist subordination. They can organize, for example, and so students end up with a greater variety of levels of subordination than do cult members. Thus, I do not argue that professional training is always the same as cult indoctrination. Rather, I argue that life in graduate or professional school can be very much like life in a cult, and that for students who aren't careful, it will be. Of course, a few faculty members are exceptions to the rule and support students who resist the strong pressure to conform. Unfortunately, because professors themselves are a product of the selective system of weeding out and transformation that they now operate, faculty members who refuse to get with the program are few and far between. They can usually be identified by their participation with student activists in struggles against university authorities, and by their own tenure battles. Just because professional training programs are structured like brainwashing schemes does not at all mean you should stay away from them, for you can defeat their subordinating features and achieve the opposite of the usual outcome. Graduate or professional school can be fun and fulfilling, or arduous and alienating, depending in part on how you handle it. For me, it was the former. Graduate school amounted to getting paid to pursue my own interests. I learned some more physics, taught undergraduates as a teaching assistant, did research, audited interesting classes outside the department, did a lot of work with other activists, basically had a great and rewarding time. Yet for many other students in the very same program, graduate school was unrelentingly stressful. They emerged looking and acting like broken versions of their former selves. Graduate or professional school can enlighten and empower you personally and boost your self-confidence and self-respect. But that is not its purpose, and so these things will not happen automatically. In fact, the process of readying you to play a subordinate role at work acts against such goals. However, students who understand the subordinating themes that pervade the training environment can resist subordination and make their professional training a transforming experience in the positive sense of the term. Thus, my purpose in describing the features common to all brainwashing schemes is to help immunize students against them. Simple awareness of how indoctrination systems work is a big step toward undermining their effectiveness. As psychiatry professor Louis Jolion West noted in a report about training Air Force flight crews to resist brainwashing as prisoners of war, a realistic, undistorted, truthful account of what a man can expect constitutes a major protection for him. Close quote. Familiarity with the subordinating measures reduces unreasonable fears, opening the door to resistance. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. We're in Chapter 14, titled Resisting Indoctrination, and going on to the next subsection of the chapter, which is titled Brainwashing and Resistance. Brainwashing, also known as coercive persuasion, thought reform, mind control, and menticide, might jokingly be defined as activity that persuades people to adopt beliefs that you don't like. Indeed, people are more likely to label an activity brainwashing if they don't like the beliefs it advances. However, if one has a clear definition of the word, then one can both avoid name-calling when a process isn't brainwashing and confidently say that's brainwashing when it really is. I use the word brainwashing to mean activity that pushes people toward unquestioning acceptance of any ideas and away from critical thinking. Brainwashing, then, is the opposite of education, which is activity that develops a person's critical faculties. Why choose critical thinking as the litmus test for brainwashing? Because it is what makes a human being an individual. People are individuals biologically, of course, but they are individuals socially only if they maintain an independent perspective. And doing this is an ongoing creative process based on critical thinking. And why is it so important that people be individuals? Because the thinking that people do when they create their own ideology, their own vision for society, is broader than the thinking involved in following a perspective that is given. The demands of this intellectual independence make individuals savvier thinkers, and therefore the best able to take care of themselves, serve others, and work for a better society. Because of their broader perspective, individuals make better personal decisions and take better advantage of whatever opportunities arise. And ironically, true individuals are the only people strong enough to overcome individualism, the self-centered orientation encouraged by those who favor the status quo. They alone have the strength to place unity above self and to work effectively for the good of the community. Only individuals, working together, can stand up to the forces of the status quo and make the world a better place. Any social movement populated by brainwashed followers is inherently weak and will eventually fail, for two reasons. First, the movement's leaders aren't always around, and dependent thinkers have difficulty taking initiative on their own. They can't seize opportunity because they don't have the creativity to even recognize it. And when their leaders show it to them, they can't do the creative thinking, innovation, and on-the-spot decision-making necessary to make the most of it. Second, a movement of dependent thinkers is easily disabled. One need only take out the leaders, or more typically co-opt them, and the faithful will be neutralized en masse. All groups that brainwash their members use the same basic process. They simultaneously break down the recruit's existing identity and rebuild the person as a follower. Any system working toward that end will have many of the eight features listed below. Robert J. Lifton's classic study of brainwashing, thought reform, and the psychology of totalism provided the basis for this list, to which I've added items 1 and 7. Learning to accept a totally subordinate role is the unifying theme of the eight features. To illustrate a few of the many ways in which the features manifest themselves in professional training, I've included first-person accounts from former students. I deliberately selected 4 people who made it through professional training with their values mostly intact, and they describe some of the steps they took to accomplish that. Ian, Rod, and John are sociologists, and Ted is a physicist. But the kinds of problems they faced occur in every field. For their protection, I'm not using their real names. Examples of the 8 subordinating themes and of resistance to them could come just as easily from professional training in law, psychology, history, medicine, or any other field. Number 1. Big promises. People do not let organizations take charge of their lives and change their personal identity unless they are dissatisfied with who they are and desperate to do something about it. Totalist organizations offer a new and appealing identity, that of a self-actualized person doing work of supreme importance. Desire for the promised new identity motivates the recruit to go through the difficult and abusive process of conversion. The new you will do big things for yourself and for the world. Become a disciple of Jesus Christ and evangelize the entire world within this generation. The International Churches of Christ, formerly the Boston Church of Christ. Or, foster economic and scientific progress, the Republican form of government, and the inalienable right to life for all people, the Lyndon LaRouche movement, or enrich your life with a higher understanding of truth, the divine principle, and find true love and lasting solutions to the social and national problems facing the world today, the Unification Church, or clear your mind of the impediments that prevent you from realizing your true potential, and thereby help clear the world of war, pollution, mental illness, illiteracy, drugs, and crime. The Church of Scientology. Or, step beyond the limits of your identity. Break through to new levels of performance and ability in every area of your life. The Forum, formerly Erhard Seminars Training, or EST. Or, be all that you can be. Defend the nation, the U.S. Army. Or, realize your true spiritual self beyond your body and thereby free yourself from anxiety, attain a state of pure, unending, blissful consciousness, and help free our society from conflict, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, or the Hare Krishnas. And lastly, be saved and come to know the truth by studying the Word of God. Keep evil at bay and hasten the return of Jesus Christ by moving God's Word over the world. The Way International. Leaders of totalist organizations claim to be breaking with tradition. Indeed, their groups appear to be very different from the spiritless, missionless organizations that make the mainstream so unappealing. However, beneath its novel and innovative surface, the totalist organization is ultra-traditional and ultra-conservative, often to the point of being feudalistic. Typical features include an unelected leader whose decisions can't be appealed, exploitative practices that often amount to de facto servitude, a traditional repressive personal moral code, followed obsessively by members and violated grossly by leaders, and a military-style hierarchy of sub-leaders appointed from above. Another way in which totalist organizations appeal to people is by offering an immediate benefit community. Life in today's alienating and atomizing society leaves people searching for meaning and longing to belong. Many groups love bomb disconnected and lonely people, giving them a sense of belonging. This deceptive recruiting technique begins with a disingenuous friendliness, a flirtatious style of talking, touching, hugging, kissing, flattery. Next come group activities in which doubt and critical thinking feel out of place. Singing, chanting, recitation, prayer, rituals, games. Swept away, recruits find themselves with an instant family-like community that seems too good to be true. Indeed, it is a false community. And any member who tries to have a say in how it is run, or who stops giving money or free labor, is out. In an undemocratic organization, the price of belonging is one's individuality. Lack of solidarity is another sign that the community is artificial. When a dispute arises between a member and a leader, fellow members don't come forward with support. Nor do members band together to empower themselves within the organization. Rather, they compete to subordinate themselves to the leaders, angling to gain security that way. As the recruit gets more and more attached to their new family, the group's leaders gain an increasingly powerful tool for controlling their behavior, the threat of loss of community. Any threat of exclusion from the community terrifies the member with the prospect of personal annihilation, because the member now draws his or her identity and very sense of being exclusively from the group. Thus, shunning or shaming or humiliation is stronger than the loss of privileges as sanction for deviance from group norms. Likewise, praise from group leaders becomes inordinately important to the member and more effective than material payment as a reward for conformity. Peers cheer recruits on and praise them whenever they take a step toward total commitment. I added big promises to Lifton's list to emphasize that people who submit themselves to mind control organizations typically do so voluntarily. Contrary to the popular image of how brainwashing works, recruits take an active part in the process that leads to their conversion. Becoming a full member of the group is seen as a tremendous personal achievement and is marked by celebration. In his novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ken Kesey draws attention to the common yet surprising phenomenon of voluntary submission to abusive systems of personal change. Recall that the story's main character, R.P. McMurphy, is incredulous when he discovers that almost all of his fellow inmates in the totalitarian psychiatric hospital are there by choice. Joining a totalist organization is a kind of self-institutionalization. It provides a refuge from a frightening world, time to gain strength, and the encouraging illusion of holding one's own in society. Of course, just because you join a totalist organization voluntarily doesn't mean the organization won't change you in ways you wouldn't have expected and wouldn't have wanted. Voluntary psychosurgery and shock treatment are apt analogies in this regard. At best, the organization's brainwashing-like hypnosis will take you only as far as you were initially willing to go, but there are no guarantees. Submitting yourself to a totalist organization to cash in on its promise of a better life is risky business, because ironically, the group will attempt to assault your identity, disempower you, and make you less of an individual. Ian went through the master's degree program in sociology at a large university in Ohio and went on to the PhD program in social work there. He told me about the promise and the reality of sociology graduate school. And this is Ian's testimony. I was really excited when I entered graduate school. I was going to get a better theoretical understanding of the world, knowledge and research skills that could be applied in social activism. U.S. foreign policy was one of my major concerns. As an undergrad, I had been active in opposing U.S. support for the Contras in Nicaragua. But also, I saw a lot of domestic problems and was concerned about poverty and the polarization of the United States along economic lines. Before I entered the sociology program, I talked to some of the professors and to the chair of the department. They gave me a message that was close to what I wanted. They said, "We've got great resources here. We've got all these scholars with all these different perspectives. You can find your own niche," and so on. The thing that really stood out in my mind was the brochure they sent me. When you opened it up, there was a picture of a student sitting underneath a tree with a professor engaged in conversation. That's my first image of the department. I'm thinking, oh, great, there's going to be this informal exchange of ideas. I had this image of professors, that they're wholly committed to knowledge and understanding and aren't that concerned about salaries and status. You know, you speak the truth. But once I got there, there was no pretense anymore. I recognized the student from the brochure, and he told me the picture had been staged. Professors didn't even pretend to do anything like Socrates sitting with students. They weren't open to different perspectives. It was, "This is the way you do research, and any other way is improper." I felt an imposition from day one. They didn't talk about people. They talked about respondents to surveys, and they never once mentioned anything about community involvement. What I saw was just a lot of careerism. Faculty members worked to pump out articles in accord with the canon that they could get them published in mainstream journals. They would talk about how you could turn one article into 15 and sneak them by. No one even spoke about working for social change. That was far from their minds. Many graduate students quickly left the program or adapted to the crass careerist perspective. I stayed but didn't adapt, and so I experienced a lot of conflict. For example, I was in a statistics class and I raised a question about the philosophical basis behind t-tests. It was simple stats, but I wanted to know the basis for the assumption that humans work the same way as the objects of study in hard sciences. Basically, the instructor said, "Well, I can't answer that. We're just here to learn the techniques." About a week later, I was in the elevator and met the student who had won the Student of the Year award. She had heard through the grapevine about my questioning and said to me straightforwardly, "People like you don't make it here." I said, "What do you mean, people like me?" She said, "Qualitative researchers who ask all these questions." Then she just stepped out of the elevator and walked off without waiting for my response. She is now a professor at some Big Ten school. Incidents like that really made me see that students were lined up with different professors, trying to get their little assistantships and their research grants and so on. They weren't a unified front. They were the opposite of that. That bothered me. It wasn't like we were sitting together and saying, "Well, okay, they're full of shit, but we gotta go through, so let's cooperate to get through." The department chair ran a pro-seminar class for first-year students. In our first meeting, the professor told us the tricks of the trade. He told us how to pad our vitae. He made comments like, "Controversial work is hard to publish," and "Find projects that don't require much time." He sounded like a crass efficiency buffoon. Issues of quality were skirted through the entire quarter. Students would ask a lot of questions like, "So our whole goal is just to write articles for journals?" Basically, the response was, "There are only 5 good journals in sociology. You want to publish in those. And you're right. That's all your work in sociology is." Someone would ask, "What about teaching? Or what about community work?" "Well, you can throw that in, but that's not really what matters." This was only the first quarter, and I'm getting all of these messages, and I'm thinking I'm about ready to quit. But I didn't quit. I think one of the reasons was that I didn't see any alternative spaces where I could go. I had my whole identity with it. Without seeing anything better, I stuck it out. While sticking it out, Ian did things that kept his values alive. Continuing with Ian's testimony, "I don't know if I would have made it if I hadn't found like-minded friends in other departments. We had an informal group where we would discuss ideas and readings in much greater depth than in class, and we would edit each other's papers. I could get help from them, and there wasn't any catch in it. This group was very important to me." In my own department, 2 other students and I organized the graduate students around a departmental issue, and this created an atmosphere of solidarity. Students were upset that not everyone got financial support. The teaching and research assistantships were given out by a mysterious ABC ranking of students. A rank people automatically got funding. B was like maybe. C meant probably not. Several of the students, including me, started asking, "What's the criteria?" Finally, we got a meeting with the head of the graduate program. One of the 40 or so angry students at the meeting asked why the department had all this money for computers, but not enough for students. The professor answered that the department couldn't do anything about that, because the money comes in chunks designated for specific purposes. I thought, "Well, let's look this up," and I did. And at our next meeting of graduate students, I presented information indicating that he was lying. Everyone at the meeting was getting all pissed off. We were going, "Yeah, maybe we'll go on strike." We were really working together. But then one of the students who was in the A group raised his hand and said, "I don't know if I can be a part of this organization anymore, because it sounds like we're going to have a tyranny of the majority." He was thinking that if we challenged the way funding was done, he was going to lose his. He got up and left, just walked out, but no one else did. We decided that instead of going to the chair, we would go out and make this a public event. We organized an 8-hour rally with leaflets, petitions, signs, and people with megaphones. Almost all of the participants were women. We pretended that this was what the department had told us was true, and that undergraduate education was suffering because the state and university weren't providing enough money for teaching assistants. We used the sociology department only as an example. TV, radio, newspapers, they all came out. They talked to us and then went and talked to the sociology department. The chair was scared shitless. Mysteriously, a week later, we found a memo in our mailboxes saying that everyone got funding. It was great to work together, and we ended up creating a small, ongoing coalition of students within the department. Ian's participation in the study group and student organization, both of which were independent of his university department, allowed him to experience some of the free intellectual development and fair treatment that the university promises but doesn't automatically deliver. His experience illustrates how a university graduate program, like any other organization whose real priority is to get people to play a subordinate role, keeps its recruiting promises only to the extent that it is forced to do so. And I've been reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives, written by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. For more information on the book and its author, visit www.disciplinedminds.com. And if you'd like to contact us here at the show, visit our website, unwelcomeguests.org. And if you're emailing us, please refer to the show in the subject line of your message to help us distinguish it from the deluge of spam.
So my favorite T-shirt is a T-shirt made in Canada. I think somebody in Alberta puts it out. It's called. It has a picture of G.W. Bush and the words "International Terrorist" on it. And you can get your very own at internationalterrorists.com. And I find that it's the best T-shirt to wear in the U.S. To make friends. And especially outside of the U.S., it's even better. But within the U.S., it's really quite. I'm absolutely serious. In any urban area in the United States, I challenge you to wear that T-shirt and see if you will get any negative response, because you won't. People love it. Just be careful when you go to the suburbs. But you don't really need to be careful in the suburbs, because white middle class people tend to be sort of not directly violent themselves. They pay other people to do that, kind of thing. They're thinking of their dental bills. I don't know what they're, what's going on in their heads. I got called a jackass by a yuppie in the airport one time in D.C., but that was about as mad as he could get, and he ran away after he said it, But otherwise, like in urban areas, people are just like asking where I can get it, including in the airport. So the government workers, the transportation safety people, the customs people, the of course all the people at the chain stores, they all want to know where they can get it. They love it,
If you still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me, then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.